director of the Adult Migrant English Program Research Center and at Zayed University in the United Arab Emirates, where she's setting up the UAE Center for Bilingualism and Bilingual Education. Before that, Ingrid has held positions at the University of Basel, University of Sydney, University of Hamburg, Ithaca College, New York, and Dresden University of Technology. Ingrid is an applied sociolinguist whose research interests center around cross-cultural communication, multilingualism, language learning in the context of globalization and consumer discourse. Her academic credentials include an MA in German linguistics, a PhD in English linguistics, and a habilitation, postdoc qualification in English linguistics. She's the author of two monographs, one called American Automobile Names, appeared in 1996 in Essen, and Bilingual Couples Talk, The Discursive Construction of Hybridity, which appeared in 2002 with Benjamin in Amsterdam. He's the co-editor of the book Multilingualism, Second Language Learning and Gender, Berlin, De Gruyter, 2001. She's on the editorial board of renowned journals such as Language Policy, the International Journal of Bilingual Education and Bilingualism, and Discourse in Society. Next year, a textbook written by Ingrid will be published by Edinburgh University Press. It's called Intercultural Communication. And just hot from the press, for those of you who read Japanese, an article on social inclusion in Australia, which is very close to the topic of the talk that Ingrid will be giving today, appeared in the Handbook of Migration. In Japanese. Now, without any further ado, Ingrid, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much, Leo, for this introduction. Thank you, everyone, for inviting me to talk here today. And as Leo has just said, those of you who read Japanese might be able to read at least part of what I'm talking about today already in that handbook on migration. So you've gathered from Leo's introduction that I could be wearing a number of hats, I guess, and the one I'm wearing here today is sort of as an Australian researcher concerned with issues of migration and the language challenges they pose, particularly in the Australian context, but I think in all global societies that are becoming increasingly diverse. I want to start this presentation by introducing Khien Tran to you. Khien Tran is, the video about Khien Tran was published on the Australians at Work website, and I just thought it's kind of fitting to take us away out of this cozy lecture theatre for a bit, and seeing that I will be mostly talking about language and employment, look at, you know, one workplace out there, how migrants actually work. This is a 2-minute video, and that's sort of the introduction to my talk, and once I've shown that to you, I'll kind of explicate how I see that fitting in. Now I actually need to find a mouse for this to make this work.
It is currently estimated that over 300,000 Australians are trapped in a hidden world of exploitation known as outwork.
Thì tôi rất là shock bởi vì tôi không nghĩ rằng mình, cái người may ở nhà bị bóc lột đến như vậy. Khi tôi thấy rằng mình được trả lương không có được công bằng như vậy mà tôi vẫn phải làm công việc làm người may ở nhà. Hơn nữa khi tôi đi kiếm việc khác thì tôi cũng không có kiếm được việc vào cái lúc mà tôi muốn. mà ở trong những hãng may thì họ cũng đâu có muốn tuyển những người may ở trong hãng đâu, họ muốn những người may ở nhà làm việc cho họ để có lời hơn. If I didn't continue to work as an art worker, my family couldn't survive.
Throughout the 1990s, Hien, like many other art workers, continued her attempts to improve her language skills while dealing with the constant demands of work.
At daytime, we go to English class, and nighttime, we sew at home and stay up late. Last night and in the morning, I went to English class. I have one English teacher in the class, but I saw two or three teachers at the same time because my eye flew and I couldn't see her clearly.
I wanted to show this video to you because I think it's a good reminder you know, what's out there in terms of the conditions under which people work. It's also a good reminder of those of us who are in second language learning of the social context in which students learn language, which can be very far away from our laboratory conditions of second language acquisition. And I also want to start this as a launching point for the general point I want to make, that studying language in use, for me, and particularly being concerned about the role of language in social inclusion, is really, as far as I'm concerned, not about language. It's about the people who use language. So one of the things I always say to my students, and I hope I kind of can carry this through this lecture, is really, our work is about the people who use language and not necessarily about language per se. So the way I've structured my talk is I want to briefly orient you to the social inclusion agenda and then have a very, very brief overview of early work on language and social exclusion from the early 1900s onwards. And then really focus on the Australian case study and see how language exclusion, language proficiency, specifically English proficiency, works for migrants in this country. And I will mostly focus on access and how proficiency in English allows or denies access to the primary labour market in Australia. And I will make a second point that there often is misrecognition of what is actually labour market segregation and the specific conditions of the Australian labour market. They're misrecognized as language and culture issues. And I will finish off by looking at what this means for how we approach the study of language in use, how we specifically study intercultural communication. So let me start out with the social inclusion agenda. The term social inclusion will be very familiar to the Australians amongst you and the Europeans amongst you, where it has gained prominence through the Lisbon Strategy of the European Union, which is sort of this founding document, the drive towards a knowledge-based European society. In Australia has gained large push with the last election and the election of the current Labour government. So there is a lot of talk about social inclusion. The term is probably less familiar to those not working in the European or the Australian context, where often other terms such as poverty is the traditional term that's being used, marginalization or the underclass in the North American context. I guess the advantage that social inclusion has over these older terms is that it has a more holistic focus than poverty, for instance, on the whole of a human's well-being. Typical social inclusion indicators are those that can be taken from the United Nations Development Index. So social inclusion can be measured by a long and healthy life. So really health, life expectancy is measured through the access of education and how well it is distributed within a society, and a key factor, a decent standard of living as measured by the GDP, for instance. So these are the key measures of how socially inclusive a society is. A socially inclusive and just society is one where we have as little, I guess, discrimination in access to jobs, economic well-being, employment, to education, and to healthcare. So the three key indicators. And now I want to ask, how does language come in? Language is not really very well recognized in the political social inclusion agenda. The social inclusion agenda is typically focused sort of on citizens of a country, mostly the native born, and how they are excluded through disability, for instance, how they are excluded through age, how they are excluded through class. The rural-urban distinction is very important. How language proficiency in the standard language of a particular country can serve to exclude people has so far, I think, been a bit off the social inclusion agenda radar. The reason it has been a bit off is, as I've said, the focus is on citizens, and those who are most crucially excluded through language, through linguistic proficiency, are, in addition to the indigenous minorities, of course, we've heard about those in Peter's presentation this morning, are migrants, and migrants often with very tenuous citizenship rights in various contexts, and not necessarily even recognized as a segment of the population that needs to be included as well. So let me now move on to what's the research about of language and social exclusion been today? As I said, social inclusion is a fairly recent term. It really gained prominence with the Lisbon agenda. Lisbon strategy is 2000s, or started to gain prominence really throughout the 1990s, those excluded from the social contract, but fairly recent term. However, the concerns have, of course, been around for much longer, and typically in sociolinguistics have been studied under the headings of language and poverty, or multilingualism and poverty. So I want to briefly outline three early developments. One early thinking about bilingualism and how it relates to poverty, and I think by extension to social exclusion, is that bilingualism is an obstacle to social inclusion. This has been with us and continues to be with us, I think, as an ideology. Started to gain prominence during the great transatlantic migrations to North America of the late 19th, early 20th century, when all of a sudden the American population comprised almost 40% non-native born from Central and Eastern Europe, non-English speakers, and this is a percentage that it was never that high, and it has never been that high ever since. And many of those new migrants, of course, joined the rural and urban poor of the American landscape, particularly the working poor, so people who are actually employed but are still poor, find it hard to make a living despite the fact that they work very hard. And at that time, it was, I guess, a very easy, common sense conclusion to say, well, these people don't speak English, so that's what their problem is. And partly, as I said, this has been with us ever since. Even today, we find movements such as the English Only movement in North America, which also has an inclusion agenda, really, and says the way to inclusion, the way to employment for migrants is through them giving up all their other languages and assimilating into the English mainstream. The practical consequences of that were in the early 20th century, the Americanization movement, lots of organizations going out, teaching English and teaching proper ways of being American to all those new populations. Anita Pavlenko has a beautiful article about the Americanization movement and how it, on the one hand, included teaching English to those new populations, but also ways of being American, and one bit being German that I really love is how they always were worried about that all those migrants were eating cabbage and sauerkraut and how unhealthy that was and how un-American and how, you know, in order to gain employment and gain inclusion, they should give up the inevitable cabbage. By the 1960s at the latest, I think, it had become clear that linguistic assimilation worked for some, but not for others. It actually worked very well for the Central and Eastern European migrants to America. They gave up their languages, they Americanized, they became Americans in language and in spirit, and it worked well. That by the middle of the century, they were American. It did not work well, linguistic assimilation, as we heard earlier in Peter's presentation. It did not work well for indigenous populations, although they also gave up their languages, often at a similar rate than the migrants. For them, it actually did not spell inclusion. So, and in the American context, the same is true for African Americans, of course. The fact that they all learned English and gave up whatever language and cultures they had back in the old country did not mean that they achieved the same levels of inclusion as the mainstream population. So I guess one lesson that we can learn from those early developments is obviously assimilation. There is no direct relationship between language and social inclusion. Assimilation works for some, it doesn't work for others. In the 1960s, a different focus, a different research focus started to emerge with the various emancipatory movements of the time. Particularly the civil rights movement and the second feminist movement, there was this new focus on how is language actually implicated in holding people back and excluding them, and moving away from the individual's bilingualism being an obstacle to their inclusion, they started to look at how is it that institutions set up people to be excluded? So they started to look at the monolingual bias of institutions. I don't need to mention the work of Bill Labov in this context, but that's, of course, the foundational work, where one of the key findings sort of is African-American children are being excluded from schooling because their language practices do not fit the expectations of the institution, do not fit the expectations of their white teachers. And so it is really the monolingual setup of institutions that produces social exclusion. Since then, we've had a lot of research really on how institutions and the language practices that they espouse and enshrine exclude people from access to those institutions, be it in education, as much of the early work, be it from healthcare, be it from the law, and be it from employment. So it's really about a change of from people to institution, which, by the way, within the social inclusion framework, coincides with two different approaches to social exclusion. There is one line of thinking that really places exclusion as the fault of the individual, basically. It's a person's delinquency, their drug addiction, increasingly their genes that holds them back, and so saying their bilingualism, their lack of linguistic assimilation really fits well within that conceptualization of social exclusion as the fault of the individual. Whereas there is another line of thought that says it's really the society that excludes people, and it's all the fault of the system, and we have the various isms and everything. And that kind of thinking gels more with the monolingual bias of institutions within the question of how does language tie in. A more recent development has been around by people who sort of broadly work under the framework of economy of language. There have been lots of studies by Chiswick, for instance, who has over the years traced lots of migrant populations and looked at what their factors for success, what's the key contributor. And most of those studies say it's really initial proficiency in the language of the destination country that is the most important predictor of immigrant earning potential. Now, this is really about employment now, honing in on employment. I will, in the following, where I kind of try to bring these two approaches together a bit and reconceptualize them more around access. Language gives you access to, or linguistic proficiency allows for access to some institutions or to some practices that allow for inclusion and disallows others. Before I move on to that, I'm just saying, so I'm kind of narrowing down social inclusion now to employment simply because many of the development scholars say it's really economic well-being that is the key factor. Kind of economic well-being leads to other forms of well-being, health, education, and so on and so forth. So in many ways, this is the primary factor that you have to tackle in social inclusion. So let me now move on to the Australian case study. Australia, as you all know, major immigration country. Australia is built upon migration. Policy consensus since the post-war that has never been questioned by any of the Australian government since 45 is that Australia needs immigration. There is this famous populate or perish slogan of the post-war era when the idea was to bring in additional European migrants to kind of stave off the Asian threat that had become apparent with during the Second World War and the fact that the British Empire would no longer protect Australia, this outpost in the Pacific. And there's also been the economic imperative that really in order to have a sustainable economy in this country, Australia needs a largish population. So immigration has been a hallmark of Australian policy for at least 60 years now. And particularly as far as the economic idea to kind of build a sizable market is concerned, obviously you want the skills of those migrants, you want them to contribute. And as far as the individual migrants are concerned, of course they want to start a new life and make a contribution. And so the first thing I want to look at is how English proficiency really allows or disallows for access to the primary labor market. I make a distinction between the primary and the secondary labor market, as many economists do. The primary labor market is sort of the official one, the one that is protected by enterprise bargaining agreements, that is governed by all kinds of contracts and laws, equal opportunities protection, and so on and so forth. And a secondary labor market that where we have people not enjoying the same kinds of contractual protection, not the same kind of solid frameworks that the primary labor market has. And in the example that I showed you, the outworkers are a key example of workers in the secondary labor market, lack of protection, lack of access to benefits. So, let me first give you some statistics from the Australian Bureau of Statistics that look at how proficiency in English relates to labour market participation and the unemployment rate. These figures, and you might ask, you know, where do the proficiency figures come from? In the Australian census, there is a question about, do you speak a language other than English at home? And if you take language other than English at home, then you're asked to self-rate your own proficiency. You're asked to rate whether you speak English very well, well, not well, or whether you don't speak English. And so that's where we have those proficiency figures from. They are self-rated, obviously, and we all know the problems with self-rated proficiency. It's a bit like the weather forecast. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. But nonetheless, I think there is some consolation in the fact that if we have a bias in the statistics, then we have them across a huge population. So what you see in this table is English proficiency kind of goes down from spoken very well to not spoken. As English proficiency goes down, the unemployment rate goes up substantially and the participation rate goes down substantially. I think that's a common sense proposition, really. In a country that defines itself, sees itself as English speaking, that the more proficient you are in English, the easier you will have it finding employment. So far that's not particularly surprising, I think. And this is something that has been noted by successive reports, government inquiries, research of various kinds. I'm quoting from a very recent report by the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission, Harnessing Diversity, which has exactly the same kind of finding. Those from non-English speaking backgrounds struggle to find gainful employment within Australia and are often underemployed, even when they have relative proficiency in the language. There are two points here, the underemployment factor. So the unemployment statistics only give us part of the picture. Another key facet is really underemployment. And those of you who live in Australia, or those of you who've been here for a while, you're very lucky and very likely to have encountered a taxi driver who is a brain surgeon from Iraq, or an accountant from China, or an agriculturalist from India. So we have a lot of people with skills not working at their skills level, which obviously is a problem for the whole idea of the migration program. That's one point related to underemployment. And the second point that I'm going to focus on a bit later is around relative proficiency. What does it actually mean to speak English that's sufficient for employment? Another finding from this particular report was also that NESPE, non-English speaking background employees with degrees and postgraduate qualifications receive 8% or 14% lower pay than similarly Australian-born employees. So there really is a solid picture of exclusion on the basis of linguistic proficiency. And the indicators are the participation rate, the unemployment rate, the underemployment rate, and the salary rates. So a number of people have concluded it's the language barrier. The language barrier is the single most important reason for social exclusion in Australia. And that's certainly true. So lack of linguistic proficiency, if the linguistic skills don't match your professional skills or your employment skills, then obviously you can't work at that level. So that's clearly a key aspect of the picture. However, there is more to that story. And more to that story, let me introduce you to another report that was not at all concerned with language, Living Low Paid, The Dark Side of Prosperous Australia, where we are introduced to a person called Greg, who is a fitter and turner are mechanical trades persons, who has 20 years of experience in his country of origin, but has never been able to find work in Australia. This is the interview as it's quoted in this particular report. There is no indication that this is a translation, although I suspect the interview might have been slightly edited. Still, we can sort of assume that this is the voice of Greg. And Greg says, I have tried to apply for many jobs in that field of fitter and turner, but the requirements are with the English. They have to be like high standard of English, and this is the difficulty I have had in the past. I've been to over 20 interviews with different companies regarding a job, but I haven't been successful, and I think the main problem would have been the English. So far, that's part of a common sense story. Lack of linguistic proficiency excludes you from access to certain jobs. However, once you actually wonder, well, what does a fitter and turner do? I don't know how many of you know exactly what a fitter and turner does. I wasn't too sure, so I looked up the job specification on a Victorian government website. And so a fitter and turner has the following duties. Examine detailed drawings or specifications to find out job material and equipment requirements. Set up and adjust metal working machines and equipment. Operate machines to produce parts or tools by turning, boring, milling, planing, shaping, slotting, grinding, or drilling metal stock or components. Fit and assemble metal parts, cut, thread, bend, and install hydraulic and pneumatic pipes and lines. Dismantle faulty tools and assemblies, repair them. Set up and or operate handed machine tools, welding equipment. Check accuracy and quality of finished parts. And in order to do that job, in order to fulfill those duties, we have the following requirements. You need to enjoy technical work, you need to be physically fit, you need to have good hand-eye coordination, you need to be able to work as part of the team, but also work independently, practical ability, attention to detail, normal hearing, no skin allergies. Doesn't really mention that you need particular linguistic abilities. And the impression I get from this particular job description is that on the basis of the evidence of Greg's interview that I had, that his linguistic proficiency is certainly there to fulfill these particular duties and he's meeting the requirement. So what's going on, actually? And then I kind of have the second thought, well, actually, although we have a large population of migrants, most migrants who come to Australia come in the skilled migration category. And in order to qualify for permanent residency under the skilled migration category, you already need to be proficient in English, because otherwise you are not allowed entry, actually. So, and then we also have the Adult Migrant English Service, which provides language training for those who come in with less than functional English. So we have a highly English proficient migrant labor force. Why is it that these people are not actually finding jobs that are consonant with the linguistic requirements of their work? And another part of that puzzle that might help me answer that question comes from a recent field experiment that was conducted by researchers at the Australian National University. What these people did is they responded to around 5,000 job ads for junior positions in sales, waitstaff, database entry, and something else, and sent out 5,000 identical CVs. The only thing that was different for those CVs was that the names indicated different ethnic backgrounds. So there were CVs that had typical Anglo names, CVs that had typical Chinese names, CVs that had typical Middle Eastern names, CVs that had typical Italian names, and CVs that had typical indigenous names. And one of the key findings was that for the Chinese, and you might say, oh, okay, then employers might have thought that these these people don't speak English and they don't have an Anglo name. The CVs made it very clear that these people had completed high school in Australia. So there really couldn't have arisen the assumption that they were proficient in English. And as far as the Middle Eastern and the Chinese names were concerned, they needed to send out four times as many CVs to get the same callback rate, just to be called in for an interview, than the Anglos. So there was substantial discrimination on the basis of what kind of name was on the CV. The only name that really wasn't, the only ethnic name, if you will, that wasn't particularly disadvantageous was Italian names, particularly here in Melbourne, where Italian actually had higher callback rates than the Anglos. So, shocking pictures, of course, around the Middle Eastern and the Chinese names, and to a lower degree, indigenous names. Other data that looks at the ethnic background of migrants and their inclusion points to a similar picture, that we are actually making a distinction when we talk about language, or that language becomes a pretext for making another distinction. If you look at these figures that were collected by Val College Feist and Marita Tilbury, sociologists in Western Australia, they looked at the unemployment rates and the underemployment and the unemployment rates for selected refugee communities. And what they found was that the Bosnians, so European migrants, had the lowest underemployment and unemployment rate, still very high by comparison with the general population. The unemployment rate for the general population at that time was around 4 to 5%, so it's still very high compared to the general population, but it's a lot lower than the underemployment and unemployment rates for selected groups from the Horn of Africa, Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, and the Iraqis. So we can sort of distinguish, you know, three racial groups, if you want to use that term. There are the Europeans, there are the Africans, and the Middle Eastern people. And that's exactly what College Paiska and Tilbury do. And again, they find that as far as the ex-Yugoslavs are concerned, their underemployment rate is lower than that of the Africans and the Middle Eastern. And here you already have to figure in the higher unemployment rates for the African and the Middle Eastern people. So I guess what I'm saying is that the evidence really points to the fact that language proficiency has become a pretext for other forms of discrimination. For other forms of discrimination that are illegal under equal opportunities legislation, but also forms of discrimination that, as Jane Hill argued last year in her book, The Language of White Racism, where she says, most white people are genuinely anti-racist these days. They, but even so, they continue to make exclusions, and language really becomes a very easy criterion for discrimination that you're not allowed to engage in, or that we really genuinely don't want have anything to do with, but where it's not okay to exclude someone on the basis of their skin color, it's okay to exclude someone on the basis of the way they speak, because if I tell you your English isn't good enough, what can you say as a second language? And most of us buy into these ideologies of native speakers being qualified to judge. Just any native speaker can tell me what my English is like, or many of us, people who have learned English or whatever language as a second language, have this slight cringe anyways, is my English good enough? So it's something that you accept yourself. It's really an ideology that's built into the system, and where it's much more difficult to kind kind of fight back than if someone were explicitly racist. I mean, that's no one would buy that, and no one would engage in that. So what I've said so far is lack of linguistic proficiency is an obvious obstacle to social inclusion. There is no doubt about it, and the Australian state has for a very long time worked very hard to overcome that barrier, both through the provision of language training in the Adult Migrant English Program, which has been an ongoing state-funded national language program for more than 60 years now, and also through a range of multilingual provision of various services, particularly as they relate to education, the legal system, health services. But at the same time, linguistic proficiency becomes a pretense for or a substitute for another form of discrimination. And before I finish this off, we of course need to ask the question, but why would we actually have discrimination in Australia? I mean, as I said before, successive governments, pretty much everyone in this country is committed to immigration. So why would we discriminate against new migrants? And the answer to that, I think, lies in the specifics of the Australian labour market, which reinforces labour market segmentation. Let me just show you this thing first to kind of get you there. What are the specifics of the Australian labour market? Or let me just tell you something. I mean, you all know of the specifics of the Australian geography. It's hard to get here. In contrast to Europe, in contrast to North America, in contrast to the developed economies in Asia, we have hardly any illegal immigration, so we really don't have a pool of cheap labour in this country. That's one thing, and Australia never had that pool of cheap labour, whereas in Europe there was the white underclass, there were, you know, up until the 50s, 60s in Western Europe, there were lots of poor people who were slowly included. That never existed in Australia. Historically, Australia has responded to that by making migrants work in undesirable jobs for a bit. New Australians, after the displaced persons from Europe, were actually required as part of their migration contract to work off some of that debt. This is a picture that I took in Western Australia, just outside Perth, on the Mundaring Weir. The Mundaring Weir, one of the feats of Australian nation building, a huge freshwater pipeline that brings water all the way from Perth to Kalgoorlie and made it possible to actually have the mining town in Kalgoorlie, was for the longest time the largest a freshwater pipeline in the world, and this plaque commemorates how it actually was built, and so it says, you know, how innovative it was at the time. And why I'm showing this to you is, you know, you're all professors in here, so it speaks to us. More than 70 refugees arriving in Australia after World War II were contracted to work on raising the wall and clearing the land for the enlarged reservoir. The contract was part of their migration requirements. The men ranged from professors to labourers, and for most, it was their first experience of life in Australia. You know, I can't help thinking, kind of, had I come here 6 years earlier, then, you know, they were only men, so it's a different world anyways. But we've always had, in the story of Australian migration, the fact that the first generation kind of needed to work at undesirable jobs in the secondary labour market. And studies of the post-war displaced persons migrants actually show that very few of them, after they'd worked off their requirements for 2 years, found a way to get back to their original pre-migration skill levels. So it would have been very hard for these professors to kind of, you know, work at the batching plant for 2 years and then go on and come back into a university career. So in this context, racism or linguistic discrimination is not simply an irrational prejudice. It's actually rational, economically advantageous behavior of employers. It keeps certain work groups out of the mainstream labor market and out of good jobs, and thus ensures by default, because we don't give them other choices, that undesirable job vacancies are filled, of which we, you know, have, as any advanced economy, there is a substantial amount of jobs. There are all those abattoir jobs in the slaughterhouses that in North America are done by the illegal immigrants. In Europe are done by the Eastern Europeans. There are care for the elderly. There are lots of cleaning jobs. There are seasonal agricultural work. So, as in any other economy, we have lots of jobs that the mainstream doesn't want to do, that are undesirable for various reasons. However, in contrast to other advanced economies, we don't have a ready pool to fill those undesirable jobs. So exclusion really becomes a way to ensure that job vacancies in the secondary market are filled, that we have those out workers that I showed you at the beginning of the presentation. So what I'm saying here is that at the end of the day, if we focus too much on linguistic proficiency and the role in social inclusion, we actually misrecognize language and culture. We give it a higher statue than it actually has, and we buy into that common sense proposition that excludes certain groups from the labor market. This is all about labor market. So in a way, I'm tempted to sum up what I've been arguing so far in, you know, Bill Clinton's terms, it's an economy, stupid. I've got three more minutes to just briefly talk, what does this mean for our field? I think for our field, what it really means is that I'm coming to think that oftentimes we are actually asking the wrong questions if we focus too much on language and culture. If we ask too much, you know, how do Xers do things differently from Yers, and I'm not using language terms here, what's the role of language in all this? How does language lead to this, that, or the other thing? I think we might actually get a bit sidetracked. It's not language that structures many things. In the case study that I've shown you, discrimination is not structured by language. Language is the pretense, and as language professionals, we should not actually, you know, see all those job opportunities and grant opportunities out there by researching yet another bit of, you know, how the linguistic practices of this, that, and the other group are different. But maybe our obligation is to look at how is language used as an ideology for something else, for labor market segregation in this case. And I'm always coming back to Bourdieu, of course, to speak of the language without further specifications, as linguists do, is to accept the official definition of the official language of the political unit. So by going on about Xers and Yers and their language and what's going on with this and that and the other language, we really may be overlooking some of the more important economic and social factors. And I've got this lovely cartoon, which I hope, you know, none of those present are, of course, engaging in, but, you know, we have the little girl saying, well, look here, a big yellow butterfly. It's unusual to see one this time of year, unless, of course, it flew up from Brazil. I bet that's it. They do that sometimes, you know, they fly up from Brazil and they, this is no butterfly, this is a potato chip. Well, I'll be, so it is. I wonder how a potato chip got all the way up here from aren't we sometimes wondering too much of what language does to this? So maybe instead of engaging too much in linguistic and cultural ways of seeing diversity, we need to look more at how these linguistic and cultural ways of seeing render people and their differential linguistic capital invisible, how they render inequality, discrimination, and socioeconomic exclusion invisible. with that, I've taken more time than I should. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ingrid. We have a few minutes for questions. Ingrid will field her own questions. I'll do the undesirable job of running up and down with this thing. I need the exercise. Too little cabbage in my diet.
Thank you so much. Firstly, a comment and then a question. The comment is about my Christian friends in New York, who say that when they look for a dentist, they would always prefer a Baum or a Rosenberg to a Smith. So that's kind of a third deduction that you mentioned. But my question is about the cultural Christian in Australia. I mean, it's kind of a diametric opposite to what you're describing, in the sense that, correct me if I'm wrong, but some Australians do suffer from that cultural cringe vis-a-vis people who come from overseas, for example, speaking many languages, etc. So how do you kind of accommodate, how do you bridge between what you're describing and what I guess exists, in the sense that some Australians are ashamed of being monolingual, and in a way, by listening to somebody who has a foreign accent, I mean, they can deduce that he or she are native speakers of the Balaban, so in a way they're obviously some advantages, right? Is there any conflict here, or is it bridged in your analysis?
I yesterday had a coffee chat about it. No, I don't think there is a conflict. I think that really exists, and I can sort of tell you about my own experience. I move in two distinct migrant groups in Australia. Many of my friends are German speakers from Europe, and I've got another set of friends from Iran. My husband is Iranian, and one of the things I find when I compare these two migrant groups is that the German lot have often experienced that kind of, you know, great, where are you from? And we're all seen as so organized, and it's all very positive. I don't know any of my, this is a sample of my friends, I don't know any German speakers who work below their level, who have had too much trouble finding appropriate jobs, so they're all well employed, well integrated. On another indices of social exclusion, they're often intermarried, and if you go to their parties, there are lots of people coming from different backgrounds, so they do not stick to themselves all too much. It's easy for them to fit in. Whereas, as far as my Iranian friends are concerned, many of them work below their level. Many of those who have failed to gain employment at their level and have professional backgrounds have had to become self-employed, start their own businesses, so very much more a migrant economy. Many of them speak about, should we change our names, or too bad I didn't change my name from Muhammad to Mark when I came here. And when we go to their parties, it's much more an Iranian world, so there are less indicators of being part of the mainstream. So I think the example that you mentioned works for Europeans more than it works for people from other backgrounds. So it might be really contextual and different.
Well, thanks for a very interesting paper. Just a quick question of whether you have thought that what relationship might be between the government's concerted effort, you know, using language as an excuse and brainwashing these people that way through advertising, marketing, whatever, and the psychology of human beings as such, what relationship is there and how it affects these results? I don't know what you thought about it.
That's a very big question, really. I mean, they're obvious. I can only, use it or answer it in the most vague terms. There surely is a connection between the way we organize our societies and our psychological makeup, but that's presumably not what you are.
It's basically, to what extent is this a specific government strategy, right, in terms of social policy, right? And the extent to which that governmental social policy can be distinguished between, that can be differentiated from the psychological traits of human beings that are inclined or predisposed to discriminate or exclude others.
All right. Well, look, I mean, one thing that I hope I have made clear is that the government response really has consistently been one of inclusion. So the exclusion we are observing is really more on the employer level, it's more on the individual level, if you will. Now, of course, it sums up, but I think, you know, one thing that we can be justly proud of as a society is, as far as our frameworks of government nets are concerned, this is a very inclusive society, and inclusion is clearly the goal of Australian policy. So it's not about government policy.
Well, it's yes, because those jobs, like the turner or whatever it is, the mechanical thing, they've got to register somewhere in order to become proficient in the job, and the accreditation they receive is from the government to become a, you know, whatever
it is.
It's
from professional bodies.
That's right, and those professional bodies at the same time respond to some ministry of something or other, Labour, I don't know what it is in Australia. So there is what the connection might be there. You know, it is institutional, yes, the effort, I can see that. But there must be, I don't know whether you have thought about this, because those jobs and the job descriptions and, you know, these people get accreditation to work as, you know, plumbers, Australian plumbers, or whatever they do here, and that is decided by the Ministry of Labour what skills they need to have and what tests they need to pass every year in order to go on practicing planning.
Another question,
I'm from India, where I live and work there, and issues of social exclusion, linguistic and economic deprivation are obviously very root. However, I'd like to add here huge internal migration within the subcontinent for labour. What I'd like to ask you, however, is a question about the video you showed and exclusion at the level of better representation. In the video, you have this phrase that during the period when the migrant was here, she continued to try and improve her language skills. Now, in that statement, of course, there is a strong entailment, not just an implicature, that language skills equals English language skills. And then the video went on to make what seems to be a logical, problematic logical link, which was that this woman did, this sweated labor, her eyes were not up to reading English scripts, the script and all the characters. And in that sense, a lot of links were made both at the level of entailment, that language skills, being English language skills, and at the level of implicature, that exclusions are the sort of physical exclusions you can't see, and therefore you have this problem with language. Whereas, of course, as you pointed out, things are much more complex than that. I wanted to ask you, as a researcher, when you show us a clip like that, and you do not give us your attitude towards that clip, it becomes very difficult for us to read what you're saying in terms of linguistic as well as social analysis.
I agree. I mean, that's an excellent observation that you made about that particular video. I think it nicely shows a mainstream discourse about the social inclusion of migrants. At the same time, the reason I chose it, I think it's a very powerful reminder. It's, you know, it's short and powerful, that, and kind of you want to orient people out of the lecture theatre a bit, and so you have to choose a material, I guess.
One very short question.
My understanding of the vision issue was that
Tian Tran was so tired that he was seeing double.
Yeah.
But there's only one teacher in the classroom, but the exhaustion just made her see three. So it didn't have anything to do with her vision being impaired. She was just exhausted from staying up late, sewing, and then having to go to class. That's